All right. Well, we are into the hour, and it looks like our participants are leveling off a little bit. So I will get started, and people others can join us as we go along. Thank you all for joining the Nebraska Lawyers Chapter Federalist Society debate on qualified immunity. We're really happy to have Jay Schweikert and Josh Hammer here as panelists today. My name is Dave Lopez. I'm the co-president of the chapter, along with Trent Tanner, who has also joined us. Qualified immunity is a defense that government officials, including law enforcement officers, can assert as an immunity from being sued in their personal capacities for violations of federal civil rights. It's available to federal, state, local officials, and can arise in a wide variety of circumstances, ranging from public employment retaliation cases to, most notably for the moment today, excessive force claims against police. The doctrine essentially says, and I don't want to steal any thunder from our speakers, but that an official is only going to be personally liable for money damages if they violated a, quote, clearly established right held by the plaintiff. In other words, the idea behind the doctrine is that an official should not be held liable unless they were on notice that what they were doing was clearly unconstitutional. I can tell you as a practitioner who's litigated a lot of qualified immunity cases, many of them on behalf of law enforcement and correctional officers, that it is one of the single most powerful tools officials have to defend themselves against federal civil rights claims. That's true not only due to the substance of the doctrine, but because in most, if not all, jurisdictions, as a procedural matter, an immunity assertion that is denied can be immediately appealed. And at least in places like our home circuit, the Eighth Circuit, where QI rules are pretty strongly enforced, that's a very, very powerful remedy for law enforcement, correctional officers, and other government officials, and can frustrate plaintiffs. On the other hand, with increased intention on police force and accountability issues, we've seen examples where the doctrine has shielded officials from liability, even where their conduct might have appeared to most people to be pretty obviously over the line, or in other words, a clearly established violation as the doctrine anticipates. You add that up and we arrive at our topic today. Qualified immunity has almost overnight become a household phrase debated by lawyers and lay people alike as we wrestle with the right answers for government accountability in the law enforcement context. That brings us to our terrific speakers who today I'm sure will lend us some helpful perspective as they debate the issue. And in no particular order, Josh Hammer is the opinion editor of Newsweek, a syndicated columnist of counsel at First Liberty Institute, and a campus speaker throughout the Young America Foundation and the Federalist Society. Josh previously worked at Kirkland & Ellis and clerked for Judge James Ho on the Fifth Circuit. Josh graduated from Duke University with an economics major and from the University of Chicago Law School. And thank you very much, Josh, for joining us. Jay Schweikert is a policy analyst with the Cato Institute's Project on Criminal Justice. His research and advocacy focuses on accountability for prosecutors and law enforcement, plea bargaining, Sixth Amendment trial rights, and the provision and structuring of indigent defense. Jay clerked for Judge Diane Sykes on the Seventh Circuit and Judge Lawrence Silberman of the DC Circuit. He holds a JD from the Harvard Law School and a BA in political science and economics from Yale. And thanks also to Jay for joining us in this important debate. I want to remove myself from the floor, so I'll give everybody a quick preview of what our structure is going to be. Our speakers are going to give two principal presentations. Jay will go first, taking the anti-QI position, and Josh will follow with his own presentation, not strictly in favor of QI, but I'll let Josh get into that, but certainly the QI-friendly position for our purposes today. Jay might have a bit of a rebuttal at that point, and then the two of them are planning to have a bit of an exchange, and then with the time we have left over, we will have a Q&A. As we get there, please feel free to use the Q&A button at the top or at the bottom of your Zoom screen, and we will see those questions as they come in and get them to our speakers. So without further ado, Jay, take it away.
Thank you very much, Dave. And it's a pleasure to be speaking with Josh and with all of you today. So my position is pretty straightforward. Qualified immunity is one of the most egregious and embarrassing legal errors in the history of the court. And the practical effect of the doctrine has been to eviscerate accountability for public officials, including and especially members of law enforcement. And while that hurts, and especially that hurts not only the victims of police misconduct, but actually the law enforcement community itself. I think this doctrine should be abhorrent to every citizen of the country, but especially members of the Federalist Society, because this is, put simply, one of the most aggressive acts of judicial policymaking in the Supreme Court's history. So I'm going to talk first about why qualified immunity is so unjustified as a legal matter, and then discuss its practical effect and why this is such a crucial issue today. So, you know, this is the Federalist Society, so let's start with the text. The main federal statute that we are talking about here, which qualified immunity purports to interpret, is Section 1983. The original version of this statute was passed in 1871 by the Reconstruction Congress, intended in large part to protect the constitutional rights of recently freed slaves in the southern states. And it's a pretty straightforward statute. I'm going to read it right now. It says, "Every person who, under color of any statute, ordinance, regulation, custom, or usage of any state, subjects or causes to be subjected any citizen of the United States to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the Constitution and laws shall be liable to the party injured." So in other words, any state actor who violates someone's constitutional rights shall be liable, period. That's all it says. It doesn't say anything about any immunities, qualified or otherwise. Now, the Supreme Court's primary rationale for why they have grafted qualified immunity onto this statute is the suggestion that this was somehow part of the common law background against which this statute was passed. And that is simply false. As Professor Will Bode of the University of Chicago has demonstrated in an incredibly persuasive article called "Is Qualified Immunity Unlawful?", the common law background, both in the founding era and throughout the 19th century when this statute was passed, did not include anything like the across-the-board defense for all public officials that constitutes qualified immunity today. And I don't have time to get into all of his examples, but to give you just a few points, there's actually a really interesting Supreme Court case from the early 19th century called Little versus Barine, in which a Navy captain, Captain Little, was alleged to have illegally captured a ship. This was during the quasi-war with France, and federal law authorized ships going to a French port, but didn't authorize capturing ships coming from a French port. And yet, President Adams had issued broader instructions to capture ships coming from French ports as well, which is what Captain Little did. And in this Supreme Court decision, the court basically considers and then rejects the exact rationales that would come to support later, the defense of qualified immunity. So what Chief Justice Marshall said in this case is, quote, "The first bias of my mind was very strong in favor of the opinion that though the instructions of the executive could not give a right, they might yet excuse from damages." In other words, Marshall is saying, this was unlawful, but it seemed to be like a good faith kind of unlawful act, so maybe this person shouldn't be liable. But then the court went on to say that nevertheless, quote, "The instructions cannot change the nature of the transaction or legalize an act which without those instructions would have been a plain trespass." In other words, the Supreme Court is saying, at the bottom line is this was illegal, this violated someone's rights, so this person's liable, period. And that standard of strict liability was the baseline common law background in the founding era and in the 19th century. And the Supreme Court itself actually held as much with respect to Section 1983. In a 1915 case called Myers versus Anderson. This case involved state officials who were alleged to have violated the 15th Amendment's ban on racial discrimination in voting through enforcing an unconstitutional state statute. And the officials in this case argued, amongst other things, you know, look, even if this statute was unconstitutional, we weren't acting with malice, we were acting in good faith, we thought it was lawful, so we shouldn't be held personally liable. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument. The court said, quote, "The non-liability in any event of the election officers for their official conduct is seriously pressed in argument. But we do not undertake to review the considerations pressed on these subjects because we think they are fully disposed of by the very terms of Section 1983 when considered in light of the inherently operative force of the 15th Amendment." In other words, the court is saying this argument is irrelevant. All that matters is what you did was unconstitutional, and Section 1983 provides a cause of action. So here the Supreme Court is, in admittedly a sort of somewhat terse opinion, but very easily rejecting the rationale that there's some kind of good faith defense for state officials who do violate the Constitution. So that's where we were at the start of the 20th century. But then about 50 years later, in a case called Pearson versus Wray in 1967, the Supreme Court reverses course. And this case is basically the same stature as Myers, where the court were involving officers who were alleged to have violated, who were enforcing a statute that violated the First Amendment. And here, the Supreme Court effectively reverses Myers and says, okay, well, we're going to allow a good faith defense for individuals who are alleged to have executed unconstitutional statutes. And I think this is problematic enough, and this is when the Supreme Court really starts to diverge from the text and history of the statute. But the culmination of this, it gets far worse. The case that really establishes the modern qualified immunity doctrine is a 1982 case called Harlow versus Fitzgerald. And here is where the Supreme Court invents the clearly established law standard, under which it doesn't matter whether the defendants were acting in good faith or reasonably believed that what their actions were lawful. All that matters is whether the rights were clearly established. And the way the courts have applied this in practice is that it requires would-be civil rights plaintiffs to find prior cases with nearly identical facts where someone else's rights were violated in basically the same way as theirs. So in other words, now, under modern qualified immunity, whether someone can get redress for violations of their rights doesn't turn on whether their rights were violated, as the statute says, or even on whether the defendants were acting in good faith, but on the happenstance of what prior cases happen to have been decided in their relevant jurisdiction. So the practical effect is that defendants, especially members of law enforcement, routinely are excused for even egregious misconduct just because no one else has committed that exact kind of misconduct before. So I could do, you know, nothing but rattle off examples of cases to illustrate this point, but I'm just going to focus on two. One is a case called out of the 11th Circuit called Corbett versus Vickers, which involved police were chasing a suspect through a residential neighborhood. They eventually chased the suspect into the backyard of a family who was having like a picnic, and a bunch of their young children were out in the backyard. The police order everyone onto the ground, everyone complies, and they arrest the suspect, handcuff him, no problem. But then the family's pet dog, Bruce, walks onto the scene. And even though Bruce wasn't threatening anyone, one of the police officers there starts firing off shots at the dog. He repeatedly misses the dog, but eventually strikes a 10-year-old boy in the back of the knee who is laying helpless on the ground 2 feet away from him. And the 11th Circuit, in a split decision, granted qualified immunity to this officer because the plaintiffs identified no prior case involving the unique facts, it's a quote from the court's decision, of this case. Well, of course not, because that's bizarre and preposterous, and that sort of thing very rarely happens. One other case I'll give just to illustrate how exacting and demanding this standard is, and how difficult it is to show clearly established law, is another case called Baxter versus Bracey out of the 6th Circuit. Alexander Baxter was a suspect who was being chased by police. They chased him into an abandoned basement, and he surrendered to them. He sat on the ground, put his hands up, and surrendered. Nevertheless, about 10 seconds after he surrendered, the police deployed a dog against him. And the dog, you know, caused really serious injuries by biting him under the arm, and he had to be hospitalized. And he brought an excessive force claim. And he actually found a prior case in the 6th Circuit holding that it was unconstitutional to deploy a police dog against a suspect who had surrendered and was laying on the ground. Now you might think, okay, well, that's exactly this case. That's exactly the same. But what the 6th Circuit held is that they still granted qualified immunity to the officers in Baxter's case, because in those prior cases, the suspect was laying on the ground, whereas in this case, Baxter was sitting on the ground with his hands up. And so that was a different fact scenario. So the right wasn't clearly established. So that is how demanding this standard is. Even trivial factual distinctions can mean the difference between an individual whose rights were violated, whether they get redress or not. So why does this matter so much? This is no trivial legal error. This doctrine has severely undermined both the deterrent and remedial effects of what was supposed to be our primary means of holding public officials accountable for unconstitutional misconduct. That was Section 1983. And this is obviously problematic for the victims of police misconduct, but it's also extraordinarily damaging to the law enforcement community itself, because it deprives police officers of the public trust and credibility that they need to do their jobs safely and effectively. Policing is dangerous, difficult work, and it's much harder and more dangerous when police don't have the trust and respect of the communities they police. Josh has written recently, persuasively, I think, about how we shouldn't be treating police as the enemy. We shouldn't be demonizing police officers in our national dialogue about excessive force and police misconduct. And I agree completely. But this doctrine, by excusing even egregious misconduct for the minority of officers who commit that kind of misconduct, has done more than anything to undermine public trust in police officers, because it means that even professional officers who don't commit this kind of misconduct, who don't need the protections of qualified immunity, suffer the reputational loss when ordinary citizens see that police officers are held to a far lower standard of accountability than anyone else. So I share the concern that people don't trust and won't cooperate with police officers, and that has made policing more difficult. But the way to fix that problem, or at least an important part of how we should fix that problem, is eliminating qualified immunity and holding police officers accountable when they do step out of line. So I'll stop there for now, and I look forward to hearing what Josh has to say and having an interesting dialogue with him.
Okay, yeah, no, I'll take it right from there. So thank you so much, Dave, Jay, everyone else here. I was in Nebraska for the first time in February. Had never been there previously. Had a great time. Had a really fun time in Omaha. So happy to make a virtual appearance back in the Cornhusker State. And I hope college football is back this fall so that y'all can enjoy the Huskers and all that. But good stuff. Look, this is a very, very, very timely and important debate. I'm obviously happy to be partaking in it. I think it's almost damning in a weird kind of removed sense that I am obviously a lawyer by training, as Dave said in my introduction. I clerked for Judge Jim Ho on the Fifth Circuit. I came across a number of qualified immunity cases. I write op-eds, essays, give campus speeches on legal topics. So I'm very much still engaged in the legal arena. But I'm really not any longer a lawyer or anything truly law adjacent as a full-time vocation anymore. And it's just, it makes me kind of sad, just at a higher macro level, that I kind of think about who besides me would be willing to give this side of this presentation in kind of the broader federal society, conservative legal movement world. And there really does seem to be just kind of a dearth of people willing to stand up for the absolute moral integrity of law enforcement these days. And I think that kind of speaks to broader thematic, more systemic troubles that I've written about extensively elsewhere with our movement in general, but that's really kind of neither here nor there for the purposes of this particular discussion. So just a very brief disclaimer at the outset, and this really ought to go without saying, anything I'm going to say does not represent any of my various affiliations, in particular First Liberty Institute, where I'm of counsel and an independent contractor capacity, First Liberty Institute organizationally, and I do not exactly see eye to eye on qualified immunity. So I want to make sure right off the bat that my views do not represent them in any way whatsoever. So I think we need to, before getting into this important debate, and it's an important debate obviously across any number of dimensions, legal, policy, political, etc., I think it's important to set the scene. What happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis was inexcusable, and I have not seen a single person, period. I have literally not seen a single person who has said anything other than that George Floyd was murdered. And I hope, along with any other American of good conscience who watched what I watched, that that officer has justice delivered in the appropriate way through the criminal system. Having said that, what has happened across America since the murder, and again, it is a murder of George Floyd, I think cannot be described or portrayed as anything other than a Leviathan-esque descent into pure anarchic savagery. Murders in New York City over the course of June were up 42%. In Milwaukee, 132%. Chicago had back-to-back weekends of the bloodiest murder weekends that it has had in 50 years. And I went to law school at the University of Chicago. The Southside Chicago is not a place you want to hang out in general. There have been one-year-old, two-year-old, three-year-old infants who have been shot on their lawn through their house. It is bad out there. And I'm sitting here in sunny Florida, and I feel very blessed and, frankly, to borrow a woke leftist term, privileged to be able to do this. But the scene out there for a lot of Americans is not so cheery. It is often kind of grim and dire. And it saddens me to see so many people in Congress, in the public discourse, et cetera, choosing now to make this argument. It just seems like a bit of a mistiming from my perspective. And I'm not saying a lot of these very principled folks have not held the same position for years. I'm not saying it's opportunistic in any way whatsoever, but it just deeply saddens me that this is the time that we're kind of launching into this debate. But okay, having said all that, let's actually get into what we're talking about here. I apologize for the lengthy intro, but I did think it was important. And, you know, I am a columnist, kind of a commentator by nature, so I did want to try and paint the scene a little bit here before we kind of get into the nitty gritty. Okay. So a few things that I agree with Jay and a few things I disagree with. I want to make clear right off the bat what my stance is not before talking about what my stance actually is. It's probably easier to define it in opposition to it. I'm opposed to both what I would call extremes here. I do have a somewhat nuanced take on this. My stance, to be clear, is not quote unquote pro qualified immunity. I do not defend the opinion in Pearson versus Ray from 1967, written by a unanimous court under Chief Justice Warren, which Jay mentioned. That is, I do not defend Pearson versus Ray. On the other hand, I also do not agree with those who support, quote, abolishing qualified immunity. And I'll kind of now, you know, I'll use the rest of my time explaining what I actually do believe. So we need to go back, of course, to Section 1983, which, again, the context which they, I think, helpfully outlined was in Reconstruction in 1871, part of a statute called no less the Ku Klux Klan Act, lest you forget the situational awareness that Congress passed what was obviously a very important statute. The relevant statutory language of 1983 that was ultimately litigated in the 1961 case in Monroe versus Pape, the key words are, quote, under color of. And then it's dot, 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 it's statutes, ordinances, the Constitution, et cetera. For 90 years, from 1871 until 1961, under color of did not mean the same thing as, quote, without authority of. In 1861, in a case that even in like legal nerd circles, frankly, is pretty seldom discussed, Monroe versus Pape, the court held that it was wrong to leave it the way it was for 90 years. And in an 8-1 decision over, I think, what was a brave and courageous dissent from Justice Frankfurter, the court said that under color of, as a linguistic matter, as a matter of what Congress meant, what the public understood in 1871, meant something that I do not think it means. And from an originalist perspective, in 1998 dissent from Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Thomas in a case called Crawford L. versus Britain, I think Justice Scalia persuasively argues that Monroe versus Pape was wrongly decided. And, Jay mentioned Will Bode, who was not just a dear friend to this day, of course, but I had him for as a professor twice. We were in very close touch. He had a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times today. I am a huge fan of Professor Bode's, both as a friendly and an academic and intellectual matter, all of the above. But I do think that Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas are correct in this opinion as a basic statutory interpretation matter of Section 1983. So the problem is that we're starting with a faulty premise and one that Congress could, because it's a statutory matter, could intervene in any day that they wanted to. Congress, if it so chose, I think could very clearly say that Monroe was wrongly decided and then restore ourselves to the status quo ante, whereas a lot, and in that status quo ante, this law enforcement, this police misconduct, would not be transmogrified, I think oftentimes distorted into an uneasy fit under constitutional law, but will be handled at a more local level under state tort law, state criminal law. And that was the way that it operated. And it's not clear to me, especially given that we are now past a lot of the old corruption, especially in the southern United States, that obviously motivated a lot of the Ku Klux Klan Act, especially how far removed we are from that, it's not at all clear to me why going back to that and deconstitutionalizing, so to speak, if I can kind of just make up a word, a lot of these police issues is not the best way to go. So that's just for starters. Now, if we're getting into the two-prong qualified immunity analysis, the first prong, of course, is clearly established. The first prong and the traditional two-prong is that there's an actual constitutional violation. The second prong, as Jay explicated at length, is clearly established. No one defends clearly established. My position, which I think is similar to Justice Thomas's position in the 2017 concurring opinion he had in Ziegler versus Abbasi, is that none of this is correct as an originalist matter. No one, again, Scalia and Crawford L versus Britain said the same thing. No one defends clearly established as being a correct originalist position. My stance is actually not even that clearly established is a proper judicial policymaking response to what I think is the misinterpretation of 1983 in Monroe. That's actually not even my response to. On the contrary, what I would propose, as opposed to just quote-unquote abolishing qualified immunity, is that if we want to get rid of clearly established, and again, I was a Fifth Circuit clerk, I worked on a lot of qualified immunity cases, I did see a lot of conduct that went unpunished. I am not blind to police misconduct and police abuses. I obviously am a general defender of law enforcement and the moral solemnity of the rule of law, but I am not going to pretend like every cop is a good actor, every cop action is fully kosher. Of course not. I would never say such a starry-eyed, wild thing. The problem, as my former boss, Judge Ho, has written really extensively, but a couple of opinions come to mind. Cole versus Carson was a Fifth Circuit case in 2019, and just earlier this year, in January, in a case called Horvath. What Judge Ho, my former boss, and again, I do not speak for anyone but myself, but I happen to agree with him in these two opinions that he's written. In Horvath, what Judge Ho proposes is to do two things. One, he acknowledges that clearly established is a problem. And again, to be clear, I agree that it is a problem. The issue is that if we got clearly established, which is what I take the quote unquote abolished qualified immunity proponents to really mean, they're really getting at that second prong. The issue is that if we do that without restoring the original public meaning of the Fourth Amendment, holding aside, obviously, 1983 and Monroe, let's even, like, for the sake of argument, leave Monroe as is. Let's say Congress has not intervened to meddle in what I again claim is a misinterpretation of the statute in Monroe. Even holding that aside, the issue is that if you got clearly established without remedying and rediscovering the original public meaning of the Fourth Amendment, what you are doing is ultimately what Judge Ho wrote in the Cole versus Carson case, joined by a couple other judges, is it ends up being originalism for plaintiffs, but not for police officers. And there's nothing principled about halfway originalism. It's actually the exact problem that Justices Scalia and Thomas identified in that Crawford L. versus Brin opinion from 98. At the time, those two basically said, we're either going to do it the whole way or we're not going to engage at all. So they decide to continue the status quo, notwithstanding Justice Thomas's Abbasi 2017 concurrence, where he rightly says that this has no basis in originalism. So I guess at the end of the day, my stance, I'm kind of baffled as to why more people, frankly, don't make this stance, is not that qualified immunity is good. Again, that is not my stance. I personally worked on any number of cases where I saw misconduct. I guess I object to the entire overarching edifice that this has to get warped into the nationalized, constitutionalized context of the Fourth Amendment as a first matter. Second, if we are conceding that we're not going to alter Monroe, if we're not going to kind of bring a lot of this back to state tort law, state criminal law, police unions, obviously, any number of policy responses, and Congress has any number of tools that it can use, South Dakota versus Dole style to try to incentivize DOJ funding to clean up police unions. There's any number of tools there. But again, holding all that aside and then even accepting Monroe and that we're operating within this context, I just don't understand why a lot of people would be comfortable with just outright gutting clearly established without addressing the obvious wrongs in our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. I mean, a case like Tennessee versus Garner is just a perfect place to start, of course. I mean, kind of the quintessential felon fleeing case from 1984, 85, I forget the exact year. Blackstone in his commentaries wrote that at common law, any force that was necessary to arrest a fleeing felon was permissible. Garner botched that as a basic matter of, and there's any number of examples, of course. In fact, there's a decent amount of anecdotal evidence, and Jay can correct me if I'm wrong, that the entire point of the clearly established prong when the judiciary created it, and they obviously did create it, was to preclude officers from not being on notice when the Warren Court was just shifting Fourth Amendment jurisprudence willy-nilly on any given day ending in Y. Again, to kind of take it back to the broader point here, what I'm concerned about, and what I think a lot of kind of similar like-minded people are concerned about, is disincentivizing people from wanting to go into law enforcement, going into those South Side Chicago, deep into Brooklyn, Queens, New York City communities. I mean, just this past week, I saw a headline at the New York Post that said that retirement applications of the NYPD had surged 411%. And the NYPD has instituted basically, if I'm not mistaken, basically a full-on pause on permitting elderly cops to even apply for retirement because crime and homicides and shooting are so up and they need people to be there. I don't understand what kind of message this country is currently sending to future law enforcement. I mean, if I were raising a son right now, I would never want him to go to be a cop given the current climate. So that, again, is the backdrop for all this. I agree that qualified immunity as presently practiced in the courts is an issue. It obviously has no basis whatsoever in the original public meaning of Fourth Amendment 1983, any of these various provisions. I question whether the quote unquote abolish qualified immunity position, as I understand it, is the right way to go about this.
Thanks very much, Josh. I appreciate those thoughtful comments. I have a few things I want to respond to. I want to start by saying I think it's important to note that, you know, we're trying to have a debate about qualified immunity. And Josh, as you accurately put it, no one's willing to actually defend qualified immunity. I've done a lot of these debates before, and I have never encountered anyone who is willing to say with a straight face, yes, modern qualified immunity is the right interpretation of Section 1983. So I think I want to respond to the particulars of what Josh said, but I think it's just worth clarifying the scope of what we're talking about. Everyone agrees that modern qualified immunity, the clearly established law test, is not lawful and is not working appropriately. And, you know, I think we should acknowledge that and go from there. So one of the main points that Josh was making is what Will Bode calls the two wrongs make a right theory, which is that, well, the Supreme Court supposedly erred in Monroe versus Pate. And just to clarify this, because it's a little bit of a thorny point, what the court held in Monroe was that a state official can be liable under Section 1983, even if their actions were contrary to state law. So if the unconstitutional behavior is just their own actions, not carrying out an unconstitutional state statute. And what Justice Scalia said in Crawford L. is that, well, okay, obviously qualified immunity is wrong, but the court got it wrong in Monroe. And so because Monroe erroneously expanded the scope of Section 1983, qualified immunity is tolerable as a kind of compensating correction. I want to make two points. One, Scalia is wrong on the object level question about Monroe. I actually think Monroe was correctly decided as a textual originalist matter. And the reason is that the text of Section 1983 uses this phrase under color of, anyone acting under color of state law. If the statute said in accordance with state law, that would mean something different. But as Professor Stephen Winter has shown in an article called The Meaning of Under Color Of, this phrase is a legal term of art that goes all the way back to the English common law and applies, for instance, it was used in a statute holding sheriffs accountable, and it applied even when they were acting outside the scope of their offices. So it encompasses false claims to authority, as well as claims that are authorized by state law. So just at the object level question, I think that Monroe was correctly decided. And if that's the case, then this two wrongs make a right theory disappears. But even if that's not true, I just want to reject this two wrongs make a right approach as a fundamental matter. I think that the whole point of doctrines like textualism and originalism is that they're supposed to provide, you know, principled, value neutral ways of deciding cases. And that doesn't mean every question is easy. But it means that we're trying to get it right. And I believe in that. And I think once you start down the road of, well, this other case was wrong, so we're allowed to get this case wrong to kind of compensate for it, then that's sort of a never-ending cycle for mischief. And, you know, better just to try to get every single question right. And, you know, Josh, I mean, you referenced the, you know, the City of Leander versus Horvath opinion where, you know, your old boss, I think, said correctly that this two wrongs make a right theory leads to a, quote, a false choice, not to mention a troubling one, and that, quote, we can get both prongs of the doctrine right. So, you know, I'm in favor of having the discussion about getting the doctrine right across the board. I'm not entirely sure what you mean by having to, you know, restore the original public meaning of the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. If you want to have sort of some, you know, you want to talk around the edges of the doctrine about what kinds of Fourth Amendment cases might be wrong, I'm happy to have that discussion. But right now, there are rampant Fourth Amendment violations going unaddressed because of qualified immunity. So I think we should just try to get it right. I do want to address this idea of disincentivizing people from becoming police officers. I agree that there's kind of a hostile climate against police officers right now. To some extent, I think that's justified because there are rampant police abuses that are going unaddressed. But I also just want to reiterate what I was saying before about how qualified immunity is making that worse, because qualified immunity is telling people correctly, cops are held to a lower standard of accountability than anyone else. You shouldn't trust them. And so I think that that hurts members of law enforcement. And I think it's also worth noting, just as a kind of empirical matter, today, even when civil rights plaintiffs do overcome qualified immunity, police officers are nearly always indemnified. It's their municipal employers that are paying these judgments. Professor Joanna Schwartz at UCLA, who probably is the foremost scholar on qualified immunity, wrote an article called Police Indemnification, where she showed very clearly that in her study period, out of all dollars paid out in civil rights judgments against law enforcement, 99.98% of those dollars were paid by municipalities, not by the individual officers. So, one, the immediate effect of getting rid of qualified immunity would not be that police officers are suddenly on the hook for judgments. It would be that, you know, victims whose rights were violated would get a remedy, and that the officers would be indemnified. Now, I think there's an interesting discussion to be had about whether that's actually the right policy approach. I think it's probably not. I think something like a liability insurance scheme for police officers, the way lawyers and doctors carry liability insurance, would be more sensible. But let's just acknowledge no officer is going to, you know, lose their house because of a Section 1983 claim. And I think it's also worth noting that the Fourth Amendment itself already provides tremendous deference to reasonable on-the-spot police decision-making. In Graham versus Connor, which is a Rehnquist opinion, sort of laying out the standards for excessive force claims, it very clearly notes that, you know, this can't be judged with the benefit of hindsight. You have to look at things the way the officer would on the scene. You have to sort of trust their judgment about what force is necessary. So it's only when an officer is acting objectively unreasonably under the circumstances known to them at the time that they can be liable under the Fourth Amendment in the first place. So the vast majority of officers who are trying to do their jobs professionally and reasonably don't need qualified immunity. It is the minority of unprofessional officers who need it and benefit from it, and that brings the entire profession into disrepute.
So, yeah, I mean, I'll push back on a couple points, then maybe we can open it up to Q&A. I am not a proponent of the so-called two wrongs make a right theory that Professor Bowe talks about in his law review article. You know, I think Jay helpfully points to Judge Ho's writing in Horvath, where he also goes against that. I would not, as a policy matter, have advocated for the addition of the so-called clearly established prong as a legislator, as a judge, or any of the above, even after Monroe versus Pape. And, you know, we can agree to disagree on Monroe versus Pape. That's really fine. And it's frankly not a particularly live discussion. So it's really not worth spending probably any more time on. I guess what Jay and I seem to disagree on is a couple of things. One is, I guess, just three things come immediately to mind. The first is the question of remedy. It's not clear to me, even acknowledging the problem. And again, I fully agree that bad cops, bad law enforcement officers should be held accountable. Again, I hope that Derek Chauvin or whatever his name is in Minneapolis gets the full justice of the law, life in prison, death penalty, like whatever Minnesota criminal code were to authorize for the second degree murder with which he's been charged. So I really do want full accountability and justice meted out for these horrible actors. I guess I question whether holding cops liable in tort is necessarily the best remedy, even acknowledging the problem. It seems to me like we should be encouraging, I mentioned there are some possible South Dakota versus Dole-esque tools that Congress could use to kind of incentivize local police unions to crack down, to change employment practices with respect to making it easier to fire bad cops. We can use local law, local employment law, local tort law, local criminal law, I think more effectively than trying to pretend like so much of this has a constitutional basis in the Fourth Amendment. And I guess related to that latter point, I think Jay and I might just have a simple disagreement as to whether the Fourth Amendment has been generally correctly or incorrectly interpreted over the past few decades since the Warren Court. I mentioned Tennessee versus Garner. There are any number of other examples. I do think that our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence is in a pretty genuine state of disarray right now. It's not as disheveled as some other constitutional provisions, to be sure. Cruel and unusual punishment clause, establishment clause. I mean, there are other examples that are, I think, even more egregious. But I would be hesitant to say that I think our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence is in particularly good shape right now from the perspective of the original public meaning of that provision. And related to that, again, the Fourth Amendment by its very text, by the very nature of the word unreasonable, it calls for a judicial balancing test. To this day, that obviously is in theory how judges go about this. But there's just been a lot of case law over the years, and I appreciate the Rehnquist citation, but there's just been any number of Fourth Amendment cases that I think have skewed and have, and because the court nowadays, really everyone other than Clarence Thomas is so wedded to some conception of stare decisis, we do have ingrained in our body, in our canon of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, what is concededly still a balancing test, but a balancing test that tends to skew, I think, more so than the rather capacious original public meaning of that provision against government actors. Again, having said all that, I do recognize that there's a problem here. I am not a defender of all police actions as a purely data matter. I might think it's a little less rampant, a little less ubiquitous, perhaps, than Jay does. New York City in the year 2018 had, I think 10 shootings across the entire city. It reached like a 40 or 50 year low. There obviously are some very high profile, horrible, horrible, horrible examples, including what happened to Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis. But the data to me just don't indicate that police violence right now is a hugely, hugely, hugely systemic issue. I agree that it is an issue that should be addressed. I really would like to start with police unions. That would be my personal policy preference. And finding ways to encourage state criminal, state DAs, local prosecutors to actually go the criminal law route as opposed to the tort law route. But I think that there are ways to do that, without fully, quote unquote, abolishing qualified immunity. And one other thing to bear in mind, a lot of these police officers, people who become police officers, just that I've observed over the course of my life, they're usually not heirs to the Bill and Melinda Gates family fortune. They're generally fairly blue collar people. So if we're talking about holding cops personally liable for misconduct, it's not obvious to me that as a pure remedy, that's going to make a whole lot of sense. They're probably, frankly, not going to have. I'm just talking very, very, very broad terms here. But all else equal, those are not necessarily going to be the most cash flush defendants in a civil action in the first instance. But I'll kind of just pause there. I'm happy to let Jay respond or go back to Dave, whatever we think is best.
Jay, feel free to respond if you want. Otherwise, I can intro some Q&A.
Well, let's do some questions. I want to make sure we get into questions.
So, and we have got a couple questions that are rolling into the queue. Please feel free to use the Q&A box at the bottom of your Zoom screen to submit some, and we'll get them teed up. I'd like to just start us off with a question of my own that blends together a couple of the ones that I've seen. I think you both are in agreement that, you know, no one from a kind of FedSoc group debate type context is willing to defend the clearly established prong of QI. On the other hand, you could say that it is defended through its assertion in 100 different ways every day in AGs and DAs and county attorney's offices every day, who are charged with defending law enforcement officers, correctional officers in a big way, and other public officials who are subject to 1983 personal capacity claims. So if we assume that sort of there is this elephant in the room, so to speak, through the practitioners and the folks on the ground and in the courtrooms who are actually asserting the defense, that it remains, you know, it remains something that still has a lot of validity as a practical matter. What do we make of the fact, from a practitioner level, that at the end of this term, we had something, you know, close to 20, 18 or 19 cases with cert petitions teeing up the question pretty cleanly to the court at a moment when, as I said in my intro, I mean, you have lay people who didn't know what QI was 3 months ago and now view it as, you know, either the most powerful tool in the world that needs to be maintained unchanged, or, you know, the biggest threat to civil rights in American society today. How do we make sense of the fact that there wasn't 4 votes to grant cert on any combination of those questions? And so that doctrine remains valid. And let me add sort of a kicker question to that. What does that say to the duty of those public offices that I listed a moment ago to continue asserting it as it exists today on behalf of their client officials until either Congress or the court in some future term steps in?
Jay, go ahead. Thanks for that. It was really discouraging to me that the court denied cert in all those cases. I mean, that was, you know, in large part what the Cato Institute had been working on for several years, was providing strategic amicus support, organizing this very diverse cross-ideological coalition of public policy groups ranging from like the ACLU to the Alliance Defending Freedom, urging the court to reconsider this doctrine. So that was a hard blow. And, you know, I don't know exactly what the court justices were thinking. I think it's reasonable to suppose that part of what factored into their consideration is that there was activity in Congress. And maybe they were hoping that Congress could take this cup away from them. I saw one of the earlier questions is which branch is best suited to do this. I think both the Supreme Court and Congress have an obligation to fix this. The Supreme Court, because it created this problem. And like Josh, I don't put a ton of stock in stare decisis. I don't think it's a nullity, but I very rarely think that it's worth sticking to past mistakes just because the court has already made past mistakes. So I think the Supreme Court, you know, abdicated its responsibility to fix a problem that it created. Nevertheless, the takeaway where we are now is that the Supreme Court, aside from Justice Thomas, who dissented, doesn't seem willing to address this. And so now the burden is on Congress. And I'm reasonably optimistic about where things stand in Congress. I think there's been a lot of activity, and frankly, there's been a lot of movement, even from some of the Republicans who initially seemed to be coming out hard in opposition to reforming qualified immunity, that now seem to be considering it very carefully. So I think that it is Congress's job now. And of course, it still is the case that it's illegally available in practice. I think it's immoral to assert this defense. I don't expect, you know, AGs and such to take my word on that, but I think it is immoral and unjust to assert against, you know, in response to an allegation that a government official has violated someone's constitutional rights. I think it is unjust and improper, albeit legal right now, to assert, well, you know, maybe we did, but no one else violated someone else's rights in the same way before, so we should be excused. There's nothing stopping practitioners from refusing to assert this defense. And until we get a fix, either from the Supreme Court or Congress, I would hope they do that. I don't have much expectation that they will, but that's what I think they should do in the meantime.
Josh, go ahead and comment on that if you can.
Yeah, so I mean, I think Jay and I are in the same boat, that the ball is in Congress's court right now. I mean, as a purely observational matter, as a basic separation of powers matter, Congress for decades has been able to address this, and so far has not. And it's really been kind of been a recurring theme of the past five, six, 7 years of Roberts Court qualified immunity jurisprudence is the court kind of swatting down more aggressive lower courts over and over again and saying, largely implied to one degree or another, Congress, you have every authority, you have every authority, perhaps even obligation to work to fix what the Warren Court did in Pearson and subsequent development, but you're just not doing it. I guess what I would suggest, and then I'll talk about practitioners and you know AGs and all that in a little bit, but what I would suggest to Congress, in fact, what I actually have suggested to one congressman I'm friendly with, is something along the following lines. I really am okay legislatively gutting the so-called clearly established prong if a couple of other things get in there. And what I have in mind, Thomas talks about this a little bit in that, you know, the aforementioned Ziegler versus Abbasi concurrence of 2017. And, you know, I think that I might just disagree again with Professor Bode on the nature of immunities that did exist at common law in 1871 when the Ku Klux Klan Act was enacted into law. What I would do in the year 2020 is if we're going to abolish clearly established legislatively, statutorily, I think there has to be language added to provide an affirmative good faith defense for law enforcement officers to count that. And then this a little more obscure language could get added along something of the following lines. I don't have the exact language in front of me that I proposed, but something along the following lines. In addition to the good faith defense, what I would personally would add is that in situations where a life or death decision is made in a millisecond, in a second or two of time, with no time to think, no time to react, the judiciary or there shall be no liability. Basically, a liability disclaimer in situations like that. Like I would probably support a blanket disclaimer on situations like that. If we can get those provisions in there, I don't actually have a policy objection to gutting clearly established, because I clearly established, you know, as Jay mentioned, kind of gets into stare decisis norms, and I am no fan of stare decisis norms. So I really do not object to gutting that as long as other things are simultaneously done by whether that's judicially or legislatively. As far as AGs, lower courts, et cetera, you know, I take kind of a fringe view on so-called vertical stare decisis. I actually agree with the great constitutional scholar Michael Stokes Paulson that lower court judges actually have an independent obligation to interpret the Constitution essentially de novo. I think the word inferior in the Article III text, referring to the Article III judicial hierarchy, has actually been misinterpreted. I candidly do not think that lower courts are truly, quote unquote, bound by erroneous interpretations of the court. So if I were a lower court judge, in theory, again, not holding aside prudence and pragmatism and cordiality and things of that nature, in theory, I would feel comfortable not engaging in qualified immunity at all if that were where my interpretive analysis led me. As far as practitioners are concerned, look, I mean, that is the current state of the law in the United States. I don't necessarily think that as a practitioner you're obligated to assert the law if your conclusions lead you elsewhere. But I would not take, you know, the hardline stance that Jay offered, that it's outright immoral to do so.
The next question I was going to tee up was from the audience as to basically what would you propose as a legislative fix? And Jay, let me turn it to you. And instead of just throwing that at you generally, could you start by responding to what Josh said as sort of the beginnings or the nucleus of what could be a legislative compromise if you statutorily took out the clearly established prong?
Sure. You know, and I appreciate Josh's, again, I think this, it's telling that, you know, Josh nominally taking the pro-qualified immunity part in this debate is proposing eliminating qualified immunity in its current form. And I think that really kind of shows you where the scope of reasonable disagreement is here on this issue. I do think that the right starting place is outright elimination of qualified immunity. But I do think that there are alternative proposals that Congress could enact that are sort of akin to what Josh is saying, which is replacing the current doctrine with certain affirmative defenses. I wouldn't call it a generalized good faith defense, but I think, for instance, Senator Mike Braun from Indiana actually recently introduced a bill that included certain safe harbors that were basically saying if a police officer, or if any, actually not just police, if any public official, his proposal wasn't limited to law enforcement, was either acting in accordance with a state or federal statute that they reasonably believed to be constitutional, or acting in accord with judicial precedent that was binding at the time, even if it was later reversed, then they're not liable. And so I think that that, in my view, addresses the relatively rare but more sympathetic cases where a defendant is basically specifically acting in accordance with clearly established law. It's kind of flipping the current standard on its head. It's saying you can point to a state statute or judicial precedent authorizing your conduct, then you're allowed to sort of raise that as a defense. I wouldn't include anything like a absolute immunity in the case of so-called split-second decisions, because you can have objectively unreasonable split-second decisions. That, I think, actually is exactly what happened in the context of the Corbett versus Vickers case that I mentioned, where a police officer, trying to shoot a dog that wasn't threatening anyone, shot a 10-year-old child. I'm sure that that officer would have characterized that situation as requiring a split-second decision. So I think it's important that, you know, our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, as it is deferential to reasonable on-the-spot decision-making. But you can have objectively unreasonable on-the-spot decision-making. And I'm very wary of creating anything like an absolute defense to liability just because you had some split-second decision that a cop had to make. But I think, you know, I think it's worth talking about certain kind of limited good faith defenses when you're talking about reliance on existing law. I'm not sure if Josh has reviewed the Braun bill or if he has thoughts on that in particular. So I think that that could be a starting point. But I think it's noteworthy that we agree that we should be eliminating the clearly established law standard and, if necessary, replacing it with limited principled defenses.
Well, just as a quick one of clarification, my stance is actually really that we should only eliminate clearly established if, but only if we add in the additional criteria I laid out. Otherwise, as a policy matter, I would oppose tinkering with it. In the current state, again, if we are able to, as a country, as a society, emerge from the current state of affairs and things are looking pretty good from a law enforcement perspective 2 or 3 years from now, as a purely prudential matter, if I were a congressman, a federal legislator, I would consider alternative ways as a matter of timing to just go about this. In the current state of affairs, I personally would not touch clearly established unless at the exact same time we added in some additional language that I kind of laid out there.
Let me just also briefly answer one of the other questions. I have exactly two cats, not more than two cats.
I was wondering if they would weigh in on any of that.
They've made an appearance. Yeah, they don't like being excluded from the conversation.
I know we're coming up right at the end of the hour. One more question from the audience, questions that I wanted to pose to both of you. Do you see there being a distinct, you know, the qualified immunity debate as it has come up in this moment is obviously focused on law enforcement, given the issues that have emerged in the media and the like. But, you know, we all know that QI assertions come up probably even more numerically in the corrections context, and they can come up, you know, even with the actions of desk-bound bureaucrats in state departments of health. Do you think if there were to be any changes, and putting aside what they would be, is there any distinction in how the doctrine should apply to different types of government officials, say in the law enforcement context versus others, or should it apply equally no matter what the context is?
I think we should eliminate it for everyone. And this is actually an interesting point of disagreement where the Democrats have sort of positioned themselves as being more in favor of eliminating QI, it's worth noting that the Justice and Policing Act, the House Democratic plan, only eliminates it with respect to law enforcement. Whereas Mike Braun's bill eliminates it, as well as the Justin Amash, the Amash Presley Act eliminates it across the board. So I don't think that any state official should be able to, I don't think this defense should apply to any of them. I think that when Section 1983 was first passed, they probably had in mind more like, you know, election officers rather than law enforcement, because there really wasn't modern law enforcement in the late 19th century. So I think we should eliminate it for everyone. Of course, the substance of constitutional litigation is going to be different given the underlying constitutional rights. So there's going to be a lot baked into the nature of the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness inquiry. There's a lot more deference for police on-the-spot police decision-making than there might be for, say, a public education official sued for violating the First Amendment in the higher education context. So I don't think qualified immunity should apply to any of them, but that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be sort of different standards of reasonableness that we hold different officials to just based on the nature of the underlying constitutional violation.
I think Jay's last sentence is basically my stance as well. I think you're getting into murky territory if you're trying to legislatively silo off certain public officials from others. Again, this is kind of holding aside the entire Monroe versus Pape 1983 statutory interpretation debate as to what actually is under color of statute, ordinance, constitution, et cetera. But holding that aside, I think as a legislator, you're probably getting into murky territory when you're trying to apply a statute or a remedy or an immunity or anything of that nature on a case-by-case, ad hoc, some public officials, but some not basis. As a personal policy matter, I would not support that either.
Well, that consumes all the time we have. I just want to thank Jay and Josh, both of you, for joining us for this really important debate. It's obviously timely. It was really great to have your two sharp minds providing us with your views on it. And it was great for our chapter. Thanks for everyone for taking some time today to join us. I will sign off with the FedSoc boilerplate that the Society does not take any particular position and that the views expressed are the views of our speakers. And I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend. And thank you again to Jay and Josh for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Take care, guys.